Nuclear reactors, nuclear lies. With the nuclear industry's ingrained culture of manipulating terms and standards by which they are perceived, all of it backed up and supported by a multi-million-dollar PR propaganda presence, it's hard to get a reliable picture of where the industry actually stands. But then you talk to some genuine experts, including one who has worked since the 1990s to compile reliable, verifiable data sourced from the nuclear industry on nuclear industry activities, and he puts it into an internationally respected reference report. And when it comes to nuclear's financial claims, he tells you,
many projects have the longest period of time for decommissioning. They're longer than operation and longer than construction. So it becomes a very substantial part of the lifespan of a nuclear power plant that decommissioning can take decades to be completed. And that, in return, has obvious economic and financial implications. This phase can be more expensive than the actual original investment.
Well, when Michael Schneider, coordinator and publisher of the annual World Nuclear Industry Status Report, points out how the nuclear industry selectively cherry-picks its talking points and fails to account for all the expenses associated with not only building, but decommissioning a reactor, you get yet another angle on how they lie by omission to keep us all in that terrible, dangerous seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, the conclusion of our two-part interview on the World Nuclear Industry Status Report, a comprehensive, data-driven overview of nuclear power plants, including information on operation, production, construction, and decommissioning. This report has been described as a barrier against utopian fantasies and wishful thinking, a tool to connect with reality. We'll talk with three of the people instrumental in the creation of the 2022 World Nuclear Industry Status Report, Michael Schneider, M.V. Ramana, and Michael Zeiler. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, Linda Pence Gunter with the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story, and more honest nuclear information than we will ever learn from the scuttled Dominion lawsuit against Fox News. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, April 18, 2023, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting out this week with two good pieces of news. In New York, following intense pressure from local communities and state lawmakers, energy technology company Holtec International announced that it will not move ahead with its plans next month for dumping the radioactive tritium-contaminated wastewater from the former Indian Point nuclear power plant into the Hudson River. Tritium can be carcinogenic and is harmful to pregnant women and developing fetuses, and 100,000 people rely on it for their drinking water. Holtec ultimately plans, they say, to release 1 million gallons of wastewater into the river. We shall see. And Germany has shut down its last three nuclear reactors. Their environmental minister, Steffi Lemke of the Green Party, said, "The risks of nuclear power are ultimately uncontrollable. That's why the nuclear phase-out makes our country safer and avoids more nuclear waste." Here with more on the German shutdown is Linda Pence Gunter with this week's Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story.
Germany is a country of sensible shoes, and I might add, supremely comfortable ones. Germans do buttery leather as well as they do beer. Their energy policy is similarly sensible. Germans see no reason to choose the slowest, most expensive, most dangerous, and decidedly non-renewable energy source with which to address the climate crisis. Consequently, Germany rejected nuclear power, and last weekend, on Saturday, April 15, it closed the last of its reactors. Germany, like its even more sensible neighbour Austria, where nothing nuclear may even traverse its terrain, is now a nuclear-free country. While Nuclear France continues to wobble along on high-fashion stilettos, turning ankles and snapping off heels whenever the going gets rough, Germany trudges on inexorably and comfortably to its stated goal of carbon neutral by 2045. Germany also plans to end its coal use, possibly as soon as 2030, but certainly by 2038. Although you'd never know it with all the alarmist hype in circulation post-nuclear shutdown. The nuclear lobby, already in propaganda overdrive, has now gone supersonic in its efforts to sell the false narrative that Germany's choice to close those last three reactors, never mind that their electricity has already been replaced by renewables, will mean burning more coal. The decision to prolong the lives of its last three reactors was largely political, designed to appease right-wing partners within the governing alliance. We could, in fact, have already shut down the nuclear power plants by January 1 of this year without the lights going out, said German economist Claudia Kempfert. The extension was more like a psychological comfort blanket, as we had an oversupply of electricity. Those nuclear plants also weren't needed because the winter shortage was due to a cutoff of gas supplies needed for heating after Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Since German heating, unlike in France, is not electric, nuclear power had no role to play in easing that situation. Instead, it was Nuclear France that kept Germany's fading fossil fuel industry alive this past winter, as the French nuclear sector tottered badly, eventually seeing more than half its entire reactor fleet down, either due to serious safety flaws or routine maintenance. So it was the French nuclear failure and its reliance on electric heat that necessitated the fossil fuel imports from Germany. The nuclear power contribution to Germany's energy mix has been steadily declining. In 2000, when the Renewable Energy Act launched the Energiewende, it was just under 30%. By last Saturday, it was 6%. That trajectory is what really counts. It's a dramatic success story, and it happened because, not despite of the nuclear phase-out, a component that is quietly omitted by the pro-nuclear pundits. The Act not only created favorable and reliable conditions for renewable investment, it did so as a precondition of the nuclear phase-out, ensuring that nuclear power would be replaced by renewable energy and not fossil fuels. And that's really it in a nutshell. Phasing out nuclear opened the way for the German renewable energy boom. Without the former, the latter would not have happened. The German anti-nuclear movement has long been one of the most powerful and politically effective. Like the sensible shoes they march in, green advocates in Germany understood exactly what their fight was about and the significance of that final nuclear shutdown. The German nuclear phase-out is a victory of reason over the lust for profit, over powerful corporations and their client politicians, read a statement from Greenpeace. It is a people power success against all the odds. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter of Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's hot story.
At an international meeting in Japan, the nations of the G7 have chosen politics over science and the protection of the marine environment with their decision to support the Japanese government's plans to dump Fukushima's tritium-contaminated radioactive wastewater into the Pacific Ocean. The seven governments, France, US, UK, Canada, Germany, Italy, and Japan, ignored protests by China, Korea, and other countries led by the Pacific Island Forum, who have strongly voiced their opposition to these plans, but remain unheard. Legally, the Japanese government is obligated under international law to conduct a comprehensive environmental impact assessment, but has failed to do so, which is in violation of the UN Convention, Law of the Sea. In Ukraine, on April 13, a Russian mine exploded near the control room of the 4th power unit at the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. A statement issued by the administration of the nearby city of Enerhodar said, "The Russian occupiers continue to turn the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant into a military base, mining the perimeter around the station." We'll hear more about Zaporizhia and the dangers there in today's interview. In the UK, small sponge and rubber balls that are typically utilized for cleaning the cooling system of the Hartlepool nuclear power station have washed up on the beaches of Teesside near Middleborough. According to UK-based marine biologist Tim Deer Jones, it should be assumed, in the absence of precise and verified data to the contrary, that the surfaces of the cleaning balls will be contaminated with both radioactive inorganic and organic material, and that the filtration systems designed to prevent the escape of radioactive particulate materials from the reactor have failed, and there may be risks to members of the public, especially those who handle the balls. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, well, it's official. I will be attending the International Uranium Film Festival in Rio de Janeiro from May 18 to 28. While there, I will be watching and reviewing the year's top films about a wide range of nuclear issues, interviewing filmmakers for future Nuclear Hot Seat episodes, and ultimately networking to help strengthen connections between activist filmmakers from around the world. I'm also honored to have been asked to introduce Heidi Huttner's brilliant new film, Radioactive, The Women of Three Mile Island. Listen, this is not some let's kick back and sun on the beach vacation. I will be going full bore in darkened theaters for the entire 12 days of the festival to give you a front row seat to cutting-edge films that reveal ugly truths about what's going on all around our nuclearized world. It's a big trip, and I'm fortunate that the airfare has been made possible by the award I received from winning the 2022 Nuclear Free Future Award for Education. However, it's not enough to cover the rest of my expenses: housing, meals, ground transportation, and, I'll admit it, dog care for Munchkin. There's no money available in the Nuclear Hot Seat budget. Current donations don't even cover the monthly expenses and have to come out of my pocket. And I don't really have a pocket, so I'm asking for your help. If you can donate to help me stay fed and housed at the festival, please do. It's easy. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button. Your donation is tax deductible, and as a bonus, for donations of $100 or more, we can set up a 30-minute one-on-one or group conversation on any aspect of the nuclear industry or activism that you like. A private networking session tailor-made for you. Donate now. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, and know that whatever you can do to help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Here's this week's featured interview. The World Nuclear Industry Status Report is a cornerstone document on the true state of the nuclear energy industry, compiled from verifiable nuclear industry data sources untainted by their well-known hype. It is used by journalists, governments, academics, activists, and anyone who wants to know the truth about nukes. Last week, on Nuclear Hot Seat number 616, we presented part one. This is part two of our extended coverage of the 2022 report. We spoke with three of the lead researchers, writers, creators of the World Nuclear Industry Status Report. Michael Schneider works as an independent international analyst and consultant on energy and nuclear policy and is based in Paris. He is the initiator and convening lead author of the World Nuclear Industry Status Report. M.V. Ramana is professor and Simons Chair in Disarmament, Global, and Human Security at the School of Public Policy and Global Affairs, University of British Columbia. And Michael Zeiler is an independent consultant on nuclear industry who has more than 40 years of experience in the field, most notably regarding the safety of nuclear power plants and other nuclear facilities, and the storage and final disposal of nuclear and other radioactive wastes. We spoke on Tuesday, March 14, 2023.
Well, you talk about the huge expense, and I think there's a phase of all this which doesn't get talked about much at all, which is possibly, arguably, one of the most expensive phases, and that's the decommissioning. In other words, once the plant has closed down. And Libby, I know you've got some questions specifically on that subject.
Thanks, Linda. Let's get down to the definition. How do you define decommissioned, and what are three different ways a nuclear reactor can be decommissioned?
Basically, once a reactor has been withdrawn from the grid, so is shut down for good, is closed. There are various stages of decommissioning. Like the first thing to do is to take out the spent fuel from the reactor core. And then you have to remove the older fuel from the cooling ponds that keep the spent fuel cool for a number of years. And then you have to actually deconstruct the facilities. And you have like three basic approaches. One is immediate decommissioning. You close the reactor and you start taking things apart. Then you have a second one that is delayed decommissioning, and that can be decades. People call it also long-term enclosure. So what you would do is you would basically mothball facilities and profit of decay of radiation for a number of decades, and then you would actually start deconstructing the facilities. The final option is what they call entombment, which was never really done to my knowledge, but is basically from that long-term enclosure state, you are not proceeding with taking things apart, but you try to keep things on site. So you create some kind of an entombment of parts of the facilities. Those are three basic approaches. Now, one thing statistically, which is striking, we are now at over 200 reactors that have been closed around the world. And there's only 22 where the technical decommissioning was completed. That means that things have been taken apart, but there's only 10 that were brought to a point which is called greenfield, which means nothing else, but you can use the property for other purposes, unrestricted. And you have a dozen other sites where the decommissioning is completed, but you have, for example, still spent fuel on the site. So you cannot use it for other purposes. Or you have other waste products that are still on site. Or you have contamination of soil. So you cannot really use the property for other purposes. So we're talking 10 out of over 200 closed reactors that have been brought to a greenfield situation. And one should also say that most of these reactors are very small first generation reactors, very difficult to compare with a reactor that can be 10, 20, 30 times larger than the actual completed decommissioning projects.
And you point out in the report that none of the early nuclear states, the UK, France, Russia, and Canada, have fully decommissioned a single reactor. What are the implications of that trend?
Well, it really raises the question if you look at the time lapse. If you look at a nuclear power plant project in three phases, construction, operation, decommissioning. You realize that in practice, many projects have the longest period of time for decommissioning. They're longer than operation and longer than construction. So it becomes a very substantial part of the lifespan, if I may say so, of a nuclear power plant, that decommissioning can take decades to be completed. And that, in return, has obvious economic and financial implications. So this phase can be more expensive than the actual original investment phase.
Ramana?
I'd just like to add that we have seen a trend in the US to try and shorten that by companies like Holtec. And I know you have had people like Diane Turco talk about it. Any of those attempts to try and shorten it and cheapen it are only going to end up in a disaster. And so we don't want that to happen either.
As I say often on the show, the last thing we want to hear in connection with anything nuclear is faster and cheaper. Decommissioning is fantastically expensive. So how are these costs factored into the price of new reactors, for example?
I think that's now full inclusion of the decommissioning costs, because the old thinking within the companies was that you have the decrease of costs which lie in future, which lie 40 years, 60 years in advance. And so you save a small part of money when this money grows up to in 60 years and then you have the money. That leads to the situation that no project was included the cost of decommissioning, because that thinking always said we earn the money by time consuming. Secondly, most countries which operate nuclear powers have no clear legislation and no clear obligation for their operators to do something for the financiation of the decommissioning. Third thing is that there's a lack of legislation that you have to decommission. In the most countries, it's just an idea that the decommissioning comes after the operation. It's like in other industrial facilities, in mining, for example, there's also no thinking on decommissioning, and it means the operators have no clear vision to decommission. And only if the country decides on legislation and on surveillance of the operators to look that relatively fast decommissioning will happen after shutdown, only then you have a clear pressure to decommission. Nevertheless, you need for decommissioning, if you have a well-organized decommissioning, well-financed and well-managed decommissioning, then you need something like 17 to 20 years for that. It cannot run faster than that. And this figure shows also the difficulty to hold the pressure for a specific operator to continue with the work.
Considering nuclear versus renewables, and that argument is ongoing, Linda has some things to add. Linda?
Well, I noticed that you write in the report that the growth of renewable energy is now not only outcompeting nuclear power, but is rapidly overtaking fossil fuels and has become the source of economic choice for new generation. Do you see this trend continuing? And if so, are market forces driving this, despite the apparent push, especially here in the US, but elsewhere, to not only maintain existing nuclear power plants, but to fund the construction of new ones?
I think it's absolutely clear if we look at the numbers. The vast majority of investment goes into renewables, and very little, comparatively little, goes into nuclear power extension. It's not only in China the case, but I think India is an excellent example. And Ramana, who is Indian descent, he knows the situation much better. But I thought it's fascinating to see what happened over the past few years in terms of especially solar and wind development, and where solar power is now competing in the market with existing, like new solar is competing with existing coal fire. So it shows how dramatically the situation is changing. And that is strictly market forces. So it's rather the question whether, in spite of the market forces, certain governments maintain their obsession, or I don't know how to call it, but their development ideas for nuclear power or lifetime extensions for existing fleets, because it's certainly not market forces that drive nuclear power up. It's very clearly a loser in the market, and it's pretty much driven out of the marketplace, except for cases where countries that keep building nuclear power plants or extending lifetimes, they don't do it for market reasons. They do it for other reasons. And that's a whole debate. It's obviously a question, what are the remaining drivers to actually build a nuclear power plant or do lifetime extensions? Ramana,
just to add to that, I think in terms of investment, if you look at investment in nuclear power, it's still very much dominated by government investments in a way that renewables is not showing. And there's much more private sector investment in renewables. In terms of when private companies do invest in nuclear power, it's only when they can find a way to pass on a lot of the cost to taxpayers and ratepayers. as is the case with, for example, the RAB model in the UK or in the way that it happened in South Carolina and Georgia in the United States. In terms of India, Michael said, is an outstanding story where both wind and solar started much, much after nuclear. India was one of the early adopters of nuclear power and has always sort of invested heavily from the government and government support. And yet today, both wind and solar in 2021 were generating about 150% of what nuclear power is generating. And that number is just growing very fast.
Just with the renewables, you know, we talked about headlines earlier. I think, Michael Schneider, you might have referenced this already, but you note in the report that in 2021, wind and solar alone reached a 10.2% share of power generation, the first time wind and solar power have provided more than 10% of global power and surpassing the contribution, obviously, of nuclear energy. So can you talk a little bit, again, maybe it's a factor of economics, but why are renewables finally, very late in the day, finally doing so tremendously well and on this dramatic upward trajectory that we see on a lot of the graphs that you provide with the report?
It's very clearly the cost evolution that has been the key driver. I mean, if you think that since 2009, according to figures from Lazar Bank, which is one of the oldest financial institutions in the world, they do these annual assessments of the levelized cost of energy, which is basically you look at the technology over the entire lifetime of the technology and you factor in the costs of investment and the costs of operating these facilities. And sometimes, not always, but sometimes at least partially decommissioning. If you do that, Lazar illustrates that solar costs went down by roughly a factor of 10. Wind power dropped by over 70%. And nuclear power, based on US costs, has increased by over a third. So again, we have this scissors effect where the gap gets larger and larger. And so it's an obvious incentive to go for certain renewables, especially solar, over the past 3 to 5 years, which has taken off incredibly. And the difference now with the nuclear costs, to give you an idea, the assessment of solar and wind, you know, mainly around the world, various estimates agree that it's around $40 per megawatt hour or lower for wind and solar. And we see that the lowest cost estimate for nuclear power is from the International Energy Agency. That's the OECD's branch of energy. The estimate is $99 per megawatt hour. So 40 versus 99. As a side comment, I adore the precision of just under 100 for that number. It sounds like a sales pitch, isn't it? It's $99 per megawatt hour. But if you look at Lazar's numbers above 160, and there's other estimates that go way beyond $200 per megawatt hour. So that difference, I mean, it means that the lowest difference you can get is a factor of 2.5 in the estimates. And now you are getting, let me tell you one example, which really has been striking me. We've seen the first negative prices for a solar development in Portugal. A developer was signing a PPA, a power purchase agreement, paying €5 per megawatt hour for each generated solar megawatt hour. Five euros. Why? Because it was a package deal, which they won, which was wind, solar, and storage. So in order to get the whole package, they agreed to pay for the solar part. And it illustrates that the difference now between nuclear and solar allows now to include storage or other flexibility system adaptation to renewables. You know, the margin is so huge, might as well put in this happened in Portugal, hydro storage or battery storage. You got the money. You know, it's still cheaper than building a nuclear plant. So that situation is clearly the key driver of what we're seeing around the world.
One country where we obviously don't see that is Ukraine. And I'm very cognizant of the fact that if Ukraine was running right now on renewable energy and not nuclear power, there wouldn't be this extreme level of alarm over the really dangerous situation of, for the first time, having reactors in a war zone. And as you said at the beginning of this program, one of the obvious new chapters that you were, I'm sure, rather reluctantly forced to introduce in this year's or last year's report is the chapter on nuclear power plants in war. So, Michael Zeiler, I wanted to turn to you now, as I believe the primary author or the sole author of this chapter, to talk a little bit about Ukraine, in which we're seeing, as I mentioned, reactors in a war zone, particularly the 6 reactor Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, the biggest one in Europe. Before we talk about the specific risks, though, that these plants pose, let's talk a little bit about the International Atomic Agency, because they've mentioned, you know, they keep talking about, let's try to make these safe zones. We need a safe zone around Zaporizhia, i.e. no combat, but nothing of the kind has happened yet. And I think you describe it in the report as quote unquote wishful thinking. Why do you say that? Do you think that's a complete impossibility, even though it would only minimize some of the risks, clearly?
In the report, we split it strongly between the Ukraine situation and the general situation in war. The reason for that is that there are physical constraints which govern the behavior of nuclear power plants in a war situation. On the other hand, the result of these physical constraints is, on one hand, that you cannot have any destruction of any connection to the grid or any destruction on the plant. On the other hand, a country like Ukraine has roughly 50% of electricity generating by nuclear. So you need the nuclear power plants to supply the electric operation of the whole country, so to say. This is twofold a problem, because operating the nuclear power plants means that the risk is bigger, and not operating the nuclear power plants destroys the country's capability to provide electricity. And now, coming to your question with IAEA, I think the zones around are wishful thinking. It was so that IAEA didn't deal with the problems in the war in Ukraine. They also did not deal with situations. IAEA never dealt with situations in warlike situation. Also, we had in the Yugoslavian war, in Slovenia, we had in Armenia problems. We had also other sites where something could happen, and fortunately it did not happen. And it was the first time after the start of the war in Ukraine that IAEA realized now it can come to a great event like a core melt if there happens something. Then they know, exactly because they are engineers and scientists, they know exactly that they could not protect really. They could not protect against shelling. They could not protect against destruction of the grid. And so they had this minimum wishful thinking with a safety zone, which is not in accordance with all basic rules of IAEA, because they have their 7 rules, basics of safety. But this safety zone does not fit with this column. So it's maybe wishful thinking. It's maybe not really to confess that nuclear power plants are nothing good in a war zone. So that's my interpretation of the behavior of IAEA.
And presumably also there's an inherent conflict of interest anyway, because the IAEA is in the business of promoting the continued nuclear power, and in fact was at the COP27 doing just that at the same time as this war goes on. Maybe it was you, Michael Schneider, who pointed out that also the head of the IAEA's Department of Nuclear Energy is, if I recall correctly, somebody either formerly with or currently with Rosatom. and is a Russian, correct?
Right. Mikhail Khudakov, the head of the Department for Nuclear Energy, and he's a former top official named by President Putin to this position, because we need to keep in mind that the International Atomic Energy Agency is not just an agency. There are many agencies or offices or whatever. This agency is run by government officials, right? So there is a board of governors that decides on what the IAEA is doing. And so it's very clearly the member states' governments that take these decisions. And I find it absolutely striking that until this very day, the head of the department, the number two, it's one of the vice director generals of the IAEA, that is still a Russian official from formerly of a Rosatom company. And apparently there is no debate about this. You know, people say, well, what should they be doing? I don't know. And I don't know whether that would be my job to solve that issue. But maybe, you know, at the very least, one could freeze that that position. I don't know. But I mean, but to do nothing seems, you know, very surprising. And just one additional sentence to what Michael Zeiler said earlier, I think I would put it in a way that the question arises whether the IAEA tries to normalize the operation of nuclear power plants in a war situation. And as no nuclear power plant in the world has been designed to operate in a war-type situation, I find this a bit of a, you know, problem. This is what it looks like, right? That the IAEA tries to normalize, make it possible to operate a nuclear power plant in a war-type situation. And I think, you know, one has to be very clear. It was not designed for it. And Michael Zeiler will explain the reasons behind that.
Yes, and moving on to that, you alluded, Michael Zeiler, to the importance of the grid. A lot of attention has been paid to, well, what if one of these plants was bombarded and shelled and destroyed? But of course, as we know, it could be something as simple as the loss of off-site power, which in fact has happened quite a lot of times already to the Zaporizhzhia plant, and they've had to go to backup diesel generators. Can you explain why external power is so essential for a nuclear power plant and what happens if you lose it?
The main problem is that nuclear power plant produces heat not only by the nuclear fission. Most people think it's just fission, but the operating plant only produces 93% of the full power by fission. The rest is produced by the decay heat of the fission products. And you can stop the fission, but you cannot stop the decay of the fission products. That's a basic physical problem of that. Knowing that from the beginning of the use of nuclear power, you always had some emergency core cooling systems where you can put in water when you have to cool the fission products. But these systems only work with electricity, because the pumps, the valves, all the remote controlling of that needs electricity. And you can imagine if a nuclear power plant is shut down, it does not produce electricity, and therefore it needs to survive. It needs the electricity from the national grid or from another plant nearby. And that's a problem which I strongly realized in Zaporizhzhia, but it's the same technical problem as it has realized in Fukushima, because in Fukushima, not a war destroyed the connection to the grid, but the earthquake destroyed the connection to the grid. And the core melt in Fukushima has happened because loss of the grid. You can imagine a war-type situation makes much more situation with loss of the grid. Of course, nuclear power plants have emergency diesels on site. In many countries, they think that diesel fuel for 1 day operation or for maybe 3 day operation is enough. And there is not more than this 1 day or 3 day supply of fuel on the site. Fortunately, I don't know why, in Zaporizhia there was more diesel on the site, but nevertheless, they needed several times convoys of tank cars with diesel. And you can imagine when a convoy of tank cars in a war situation has to pass 20 kilometers or 50 kilometers from the next supply of fuel, that cannot be an operation which lasts for a long time. Fortunately, they always a chance in Zaporizhia up to now to make a combination of diesel operation of the, they had to deal with a problem, reconnect to the grid with strong repairs, reconnect to other plants and providing of the diesel. But you cannot rely that this works for a long time. You cannot rely that this works on the other nuclear power plants in Ukraine. They are not in a fighting zone, but nevertheless, all the other plants in Ukraine also depend from a functioning grid.
And of course, the other thing they rely on is a functioning workforce. And I think this is another aspect that you touch on in the report in relation to what you call heroic actions that wouldn't necessarily be in a situation like this to save the day, that those have become less likely because of all the contributing factors. So I wonder, and I know, Michael Schneider, you and I have talked about this as well, that it's a little bit overlooked, the impact that towards a disaster of a workforce in the conditions that they're in now. So maybe you might both want to address this, but how do you view the impact of war conditions and plant occupation, because of course the Russians are occupying the Zaporizhzhia site, on the people who work there and have to keep the plant safe? How big a factor is this in the probability of another nuclear disaster in Ukraine? And I'm alluding, of course, to the fact that we've heard stories about workers actually just leaving, so that the workforce is probably at least half of what it should be, and maybe they're working under duress, even under the threat of violence. So how much is this likely to contribute to human error, let's say, which certainly was a contributing factor both at Three Mile Island and Chernobyl, without obviously the added stress of a war going on?
Yes, of course, this stress on the workforce is a very strong risk. People have to decide what they do in a situation which comes up in a technical situation. And decision-making is much more reliable when you are not under stress. The Russians occupied the area, they occupied also the plant, and they forced to stay there. People did not know exactly what happens with their families. It's also a great factor of stress, of course. So it was not a condition under which it's possible to make a safe operation of the plant. And the other situation is that, as far as one knows, they forced some of the workforce by imprisoning them or by other threat to them. And this means that the other people maybe are forced to work as standard, but also maybe they could not, they fear that they are the next victim of those measurements. So it's not something where you can continue with safe operation. And especially if something is destroyed, if you have a shelling in such situation, you need people who understand the plant. You need people who can make fast repairs. That works also not so good as in a non-war situation. And third point, you mentioned it, that a lot of staff has left. You have not so many people with very special knowledge, for example, the operation crew of the plant or special repair crews.
If I may, a couple of things. One is on the assessment of the risk, to just put it very bluntly. If you have an operating reactor, and as Michael Zeiler explained, if you cut the electricity, we are looking into a meltdown accident within something like an hour. So it's not something that is a long-term, you know, a longer development thing or so. It's very fast. It's incredibly fast. It can be incredibly fast. So that's just to illustrate what we're talking about. On the human factor, if you think about the concrete situation of a person going to work every morning from a war zone into a nuclear power plant where they confiscate your mobile phone, you have no contact with your family or friends during the day. You don't know whether you go home in the evening and your family is dead or your home destroyed or some kind of dramatic impact. I mean, can you imagine the kind of traumatic, permanent traumatic situation you have to work under without leaving everything else? It also illustrates the problem, the conceptual problem of this kind of no attack zone definition. I mean, we're now in the second year of the war. Usually a nuclear power plant has very major maintenance operations, you know, usually around once a year, at least once every 18 months, fuel replacement, et cetera, et cetera. That's a situation when you get additional hundreds of people onto the site. How is this supposed to work? If those hundreds of people come from longer distances, they are not necessarily all living around the place. Is that then part of the zone? I mean, it illustrates to what extent it is wishful thinking that you could solve the issue by defining just a simple zone.
385 pages. That's an extremely thorough report, and it can be daunting. How do you see it as being used? And what, if anything, is being done to whittle down your findings into a more user-friendly format, especially for journalists and activists? Or do you not see that as being part of your job?
The report is really a labor of love on the part of Michael. He spends a vast majority of his time and also his family's time on doing this work. In a way, to say, you know, what else are you doing with it, does not do adequate justice to the amount of work that's involved in doing this. That said, I will speak for Michael also, and then he will add to that. One of the things I've learned from Michael is to say that we should be resources for journalists. And the number of times we get called to give comments by journalists around the world, and we spend the time to explain how we got this, go over the same points we've been saying for years and years over and over again, so that it sort of gets into the media. So that's, I think, one thing that we try to do. In terms of my own work, I do write a lot of op-eds, and I draw heavily on the status report. And conversely, there are sometimes I'm writing op-ed pieces in response to something that happened, some announcement that's been made. And then what I write in that will feed into what I write for the status report the following year. And so it's a kind of dialectical process where one feeds into the other. Essentially, there is a challenge, of course, that these kinds of materials are not easily introducible into the mainstream debate, which is completely dominated by pro-nuclear elements. They have much larger budgets for public relations. They are full-time people who are doing just PR work. It's very hard for us to match, but the facts are on our side. And that's what I think we have to keep going with.
It's very true that we're basically, with the little team we have, and you know, we're stretched to the limits and beyond. So we do what we can in terms of putting this piece together, but it's not the only part of the project. The annual report is one of three elements of the status report project. The second element is the website, and everybody who has ever dealt with a website knows that this is the full project in itself. And the third item is the interactive data visualization, that is the data viz that is on the website, which is, I encourage listeners to go and try it out. It's a fantastic tool, not only because it illustrates things, but you can do research, your own research. You can punch in VVER to try to find out where are these Russian type reactors in the world. You can filter by the ones that are operating or closed. I mean, it's a fabulous tool, but it's a lot of work to maintain updated reactor by reactor. Of course, you're right. It would be wonderful to have it in systematically, to have extracts. Also, you know, for example, we've been discussing for a number of years to create specific topical webinars on the basis of the status report. That would be wonderful. But, you know, you can only do so much in a day, and we haven't found a way to buy more time. It's definitely also a resource issue. I mean, we are not sure at this point. I'm not sure we get the budget together for the 2023 report. So it is problematic. And we've been dealing with budget constraints for years. And you can only do that for so long. And then you have to make decisions. And so we're at that point right now. And obviously, you're aware of our biggest funder was the MacArthur Foundation that decided to quit the entire sector. So this has also implications. Just one word on what Ramana said on journalists. I mean, I get on average about 2 requests from journalists per day, and it's often several hours work. Everybody who does that job knows that it's not just a phone call. It's follow-up, it's back and forth, it's correcting quotes, which are completely out of order, et cetera, et cetera. It's a long process. So we do spend a lot of time kind of translating bits and pieces of the report into daily context, into news context. But obviously, the status report is a very effective reference tool. When we released the report in October 2022, over 100,000 single visitors to the website. That's huge for a niche issue like the World Nuclear Industry Status Report. So I think it works fine, and people do use it all over the world. NGOs use it, academics use it, governments use it, ministers quote it in parliaments. So it does work. It's reference, and it's meant for it.
Any final thoughts on this from either of you? And if there's anything that the listeners of Nuclear Hot Seat can do to assist you, what might that be?
One thing that I'm very, very concerned about is what I said at the very beginning. Like, we have seen this shift, this gap that is widening in spite of the existing of the status report between the perception of the nuclear sector and reality. And that's very concerning in my view, because it leads to decisions that are not fact-based, but that are based on some kind of whatever, fantasy. Ramana wrote the reference book on the Indian nuclear power program, and he found a fantastic title that sums it up, The Power of Promise. And I think in the climate change debate, the power of promise to solve an issue that seems unsolvable is something that is very difficult to adjust to mere facts and realities. But it's really something I'm very concerned about. And I wonder, how did we get there? Because that's a piece of investigation that has not been done neither. We're actually facing in many countries, in many types of contexts, fact-free discussion on nuclear power. How did we end up there? How did this happen? I think it's, to me, a question without a clear, investigated answer.
Between the reality and the real figures and the promised figures, countries discuss on promoting nuclear power without looking on the economic figures, without looking on the nuclear waste which they produce, on which they have no real solution.
Linda, did you have anything you wish to add at this time?
No, I really appreciate this discussion. I think there are so many interesting points that were raised. We could certainly do another episode of this.
This could be a series. Are you kidding?
Thank you all for joining. It was really, as always, illuminating, and especially this discussion of the perception issue. That's very much in the forefront of all the work we do. That why are we losing the battle when we have the empirical data and they have the fantasies? And yet fantasies are winning, and maybe people just like fantasy drama better than documentaries. But at any rate, we've got work to do to turn that around with much fewer resources. So we really appreciate having the World Nuclear Industry Status Report as one of the most valuable resources that we can dip into at all times for reliable information.
I want to thank you, Michael Schneider, M.V. Ramana, and Michael Zeiler, for the great cornerstone work you do in creating the World Nuclear Industry Status Report, and for being our guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat. That was the conclusion of our extended interview with Michael Schneider, M.V. Ramana, and Michael Zeiler, head researchers and writers of the World Nuclear Industry Status Report for 2022. We will have a link up to the full report on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 617. My thanks to Linda Penn Skunter for her interviewing skills, as well as her invaluable support in putting this panel of experts together.
Activists, shout out.
No Nukes Asia Forum is asking that all of us join the Stop TEPCO, that's with a hashtag, global campaign to demand don't nuke the Pacific. It's asking that we send postcards to three key officials in Fukushima who support the radioactive waste dumping into the Pacific and demand that they halt this outrageous dumping plan. The deadline for sending these postcards is May 1st, and we will have the full instructions up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 617. Our thanks to Kimberly Roberson of Fukushima Fallout Awareness Network and Becquerel Awareness Day for providing us with this information. And if you would like an easy way to support the show, go to nuclearhotseat.com and sign up in the yellow opt-in box for a weekly email that provides a link to the show and a short description of some of the information that's in it. And you can also go to Nuclear Hot Seat on Facebook and click follow, like, make a comment, and then forward the link to two people you think would be interested in learning more. The only way the show gets out is with your help. And by signing up on this way, you can help us with both Google and Facebook algorithms so that the show gets picked up and sent further. Whatever you can do, thanks. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, April 18, 2023. Our thanks to Linda Penn Skunter of Beyond Nuclear for the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story. A reminder that you can get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, and it's easy to set up. Go to nuclearhotseat.com and fill out the yellow opt-in box. That's your first name and an email address that we can use. We won't bug you. We won't sell it. We won't distribute it. We'll just send you one email a week with the show. That way you'll get it hot off the metaphoric presses and never risk missing a single episode. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2023. Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as you cite the program and the website. This is Libby Halevi, producer and host of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, when it comes to decommissioning a nuclear reactor, the two words you never want to hear the company in charge of decommissioning say are cheaper and faster, because that way lies not only madness, but a higher probability of disaster. There you go. This has been your nuclear wake-up call. So don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.